Bonsoir.
Mesdames. La semaine dernière, j'ai fait une retraite ailleurs. Et cette semaine, j'ai fait une retraite là. Chez moi, dans ma vie, ici. Et justement, d'aller à la première retraite, je fais une formation typiquement française. Oui.
Je me demande si ce serait pas bien de le faire en anglais si les gens qui font la retraite partout veulent écouter.
Ok. Okay, so I start over again.
It's a very good idea.
So, I did a retreat last week, writing and meditation in south of France. I did a retreat this week here in my daily life. And just before going to the first retreat, I had 3 days of training, because I'm in a training program to, very French thing, be certified to lead writing workshops. And it's actually very good, because I've learned a lot in this program. And now I did 6 months of the general course, and now I'm doing my specializations. I did one specialization of working with young people, children, teenagers. Now, the one I did that I started just before I left on this retreat was working with people who we say are difficult, meaning could be in a hospital, it could be prisons, it could be just people who are unemployed or homeless people, could be people who are sick, who have psychiatric problems or who have other kinds of illnesses, it could be retired people, just a group that's not just a general kind of ordinary people wanting to write. And so the guy who's leading it, who's very experienced with these kinds of groups, our assignment for next week, I go back, and our assignment was to write something. The question is, what do they say to you? Meaning the people, the participants. And he said this question was asked of him when he was working with, I think, autistic children, maybe, something like that. And it was in a team with others, and there was a psychoanalyst who was in the team. And she said to him, she asked him that question. Qu'est-ce qu'ils vous demandent? Qu'est-ce qu'ils vous disent? Qu'est-ce qu'ils vous disent? What do they say to you? And he was... I thought this was such an amazing question. So he asked us. So I've been thinking about it throughout my retreats. And it was a really good question to have during these retreats. Because here I am, leading retreats, and asking myself, what are they telling me? What are they saying to me? Either when they're asking something, or when they're, you know, in a writing retreat, when they're writing, when they're reading, all the time, what are they saying to me? And it accompanied me, since he asked that question, it's been accompanying me not only in that context, but everywhere. So what are people saying to me? What is being, not only people, but what is everything saying to me? And I'll be honest, I don't have an answer, but I'm listening. And that has been really, really a really positive experience. Not always easy. Sometimes I can't hear. Sometimes literally I can't hear. But, you know, they speak too softly, or we were in a room in the writing retreat that was very big and it resonated and sometimes hard to hear. Sometimes I'm not in a space when I'm open to hearing it. But I'm in this posture of listening and asking myself, what are they saying to me? Which changes everything then, the way that I relate to the situation, to the people, to the circumstances. And just before we were sitting with Christine, and I was very, you know, I could relate very much with her story about being in a situation where there's a lot of violence and poverty, kind of poverty. I won't go into all the details of her story, but poverty in people's experience of their own lives and in their mentality and in their it's kind of like living in a state of constant lack or something, and then reacting from that. And it's such a, it's so prevalent in our culture. And there's this constant desire to gain and profit. And even if it's just by criticizing someone else. You know, one of the vows we take is, I vow not to elevate myself and speak ill of others. Because when we speak ill of others, it's always in order to elevate myself. And if I'm trying to elevate myself, I feel really shitty about myself. I don't feel good about who I am and what I'm doing and my life. And so I will speak ill of others to make myself seem better. Of course, this is absolutely unconscious most of the time. But we take this vow, this precept, in order to help us be aware of that, even if, you know, we have blind spots. We will not always see, but it can help. It's like me asking myself, what are they saying to me? It's a reminder to say, what is that person saying when they're laughing and mocking someone else? What are they saying? You know? And then it corresponded to, I immediately thought, when Christine was telling the story, I immediately thought of an article that I've been reading. It's a New Yorker article, and so it takes a while to read it because I don't have time to like read the whole thing all at once. But it's devastating. I had no idea that there's this family called the Sacklers, right? And if you've ever gone to a museum, practically anywhere, there's a Sackler wing, or there's a Sackler gallery, or there's at the Louvre there's one, at the Metropolitan in New York there's one. I think there's a Sackler gallery in London or Vienna or somewhere, I don't know. Anyway, there's Sackler this and Sackler that. At the Guggenheim there's a Sackler thing, or a Sackler endowment, or whatever. So there's this family of Sacklers. And great in the American tradition, philanthropists, right? A family who three brothers who fled Poland, Gelis, what we call Galicia. I'm not sure what that is today. Is that Poland or Germany or Galicia?
Galicia, c'est Poland.
Galicia, c'est Poland. Okay. Anyway, who in the 30s came to America. But it was three Jewish brothers. And the only reason I mention that they're Jewish is because that was why they fled. Otherwise, it has nothing to do with anything, right? But, and they went to medical school, all three of them, and became doctors. And in one of them, in order to support his way, his studies, took a job writing advertising copy for a company that advertised in medical journals. So, you know, it could be for drugs, or it could be for medical equipment or something. So anyway, and he became very good at this, and he got to know so well this business that he bought the company. So it's a company that advertises medical things, primarily drugs. And he and his three brothers, actually, they did some practice, but not a whole lot. But they all studied, I think, psychiatry and neuroscience or something like that. Anyway, long story short, they bought a pharmaceutical company that now produces this drug that's called oxycodone, mm-hmm. which is causing a major crisis in America, mm-hmm. addiction, because it's an how do you say it in French? Opiacé? Mm-hmm. It's an opioid, which is a synthetic version of heroin, basically, is what it is. It's derived, it's a molecule that's synthetic version of the opium molecule. And they created this drug, they marketed this drug, they hired the doctors to support this drug, they hired doctors and professors to write the articles, because now they also own medical journals. They hired the doctors and the specialists to write the articles in the medical journals promoting this drug, and they produce this drug and sell this drug and market it. So they do the whole thing. And they've made so much money off of this. And it's responsible for millions of people being addicted and hundreds and thousands of deaths just in the
past.
What
is it supposed to cure?
What? It's a painkiller.
It's a painkiller.
Mm-hmm. Which is very interesting. Uh-huh. It's a painkiller. Mm-hmm. It's a super powerful painkiller. That theoretically was created, there was a previous version of it that they created that was not from the same exact molecule that they created, and which was very popular, became very popular because it was marketed so well. And a painkiller, everybody wants a painkiller, right? But it was supposed to be used like with severe cancer cases when people were suffering from pain, or in palliative care, you know, end of life pain. It was supposed to be for that, right? And then the patent was running out on that one, and it would become, and everybody could then make it, the original drug. So they hired someone to come up with another one that's even more powerful, and which is now this one. And started marketing this one, and created just a small dose, and then created an even bigger dose, and then created an XXL dose. And the Federal Drug Administration in the U.S. approved this drug, although no studies or trials were done to examine how addictive it would be. They just took the word of the doctors who prescribed it and who were promoting it that there wouldn't be any problem. And all of these doctors were paid by the maker, which is called Purdue Pharma, it's called. And the person who was head of the Federal Drug Administration at the time it was approved told the journalist who was writing this article that he had not been involved in that approval process. And then they tracked the guy who was involved in it, was no longer at the FDA, had quit the Federal Drug Administration, mm-hmm. and within 2 years was employed by Purdue Pharma. So, in any case, this journalist also discovered that nowhere on the Purdue Pharma website or materials is the Sackler name mm-hmm. mentioned. Although you go to art museums all over the world and it's Sackler, 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 Sackler. And on the board of directors, there are several members of the Sackler family on the board of directors, but they're not listed as being members of board of directors. So I haven't finished the article, but the article is basically saying these people are responsible for this horrific drug addiction crisis that's happening in the U.S. Hundreds and thousands of people have died. And it's ordinary people. Oh, you know, it's like ordinary. This is like, because it's a prescription drug. So some people get, they go and they have root canal surgery and they get prescribed for it. Whereas I've had root canal surgery here. The guy, he gives me Dilipan, the dentist here. You know, and it's a lot, it's definitely enough, you know. Or people, you know, they have migraines or something, or back pain, you know, this kind of chronic back pain. So the doctor gives them this without any controls or anything. And so it's become just this, everybody can have it. And people, when it becomes hard to get, because then a doctor won't renew their prescription or something like that, then these people are turning to heroin because it's cheaper and accessible. And so there's these people like in little towns in New Hampshire. New Hampshire actually is one of the states that's the hardest hit by this. They've got a real problem in New Hampshire. Or, you know, some obscure town in Illinois, you know, these little towns, of overdosing with heroin or overdosing with this because it's, you know, they have these super doses that people can get and they overdose. Families are ruined because, of course, when there's an addiction like this, people stop at nothing for it. Anyway, all of this story, this is a long story I'm telling, but part of what has always intrigued or fascinated me about this issue, this drug in the U.S., because this has been going on for a while, a few years, is that it's a painkiller. And that is so, that speaks so strongly about our culture, especially American culture. There's so much pain. There's so much devastation. So much poverty, as I was saying before. And people are willing to do anything to not feel it. Of course, once again, it's unconscious. It's not they're thinking that my pain, that it's an existential pain that they're experiencing. But they're trying to, you know, there's Walmart and there's, you know, mass consumption and fast food, and all of this is speaking. What are they saying to me? Well, I know what they're saying. They're hungry. They're dying. They're desperate. And so they want more and more and more, and it will never be enough. Now, America is, and the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, once was asked many, many years ago by someone, what's the realm of hungry ghosts like? Because we always chant this thing of hungry ghosts, right? And he said, America. And he may well have been in America when he said it, because he used to be in America a lot. And when I read this 20 years ago, I thought, yes, that's it. It's the personification of this realm of hungry ghosts, pushed to its ultimate. It's not to its ultimate yet, I don't think, but it's getting there.
Il a répondu l'Amérique en réponse à quelle question?
À quoi ça ressemble le domaine le royaume des esprits affamés. Tu sais, on chante toujours les esprits affamés, etc. Mais c'est l'Amérique. And I thought, wow, these guys, these Sackler brothers. I think two of them are still alive. One of them has died. And I thought, wow, you know, this is what happens when greed, anger, and ignorance are not seen and dealt with, because profit, gain, having myself seen as great and good, and they've done a lot of great things with their money, you know. They've done a lot of great things, but at what expense? You know, what are we willing to do to aggrandize ourselves and make ourselves rich and make leave a lasting impression? Because that's apparently what they quoted one of the brothers in the beginning as saying. Forget in what context, but saying if you that he told the rest of his family that if you want to leave a trace in the world, if you want anything to last after you leave, you have to do this. You have to like buy artwork and create buildings and put your name on, you know, concert halls and things like that. All of this to leave a trace of something that is not a thing, you know? This existence, this being, there is no trace, you know? And unfortunately, part of the trace they're leaving is death and devastation. And a horrific health problem in America. And you know, it's taken... Trump, you know, they've been pressuring him to declare a national emergency, because if you declare a national emergency, then there is all this federal money that kicks in, and there's an effort that starts to, an effort, and he's like been, you know, not really doing it, and not devoting any resources to it.
He's probably taking the
credit. Right, who knows, you know, he's probably on the take in this, you know, or he's like, who knows, but whatever. For his own profit and gain, he's not doing it. You know? And you know, we can look at this and say, well, we all do this all the time in different ways. You know? We do things to make ourselves look better. We want to accumulate things. We want to... become something, become someone, have ourselves be recognized, and at what expense, you know, whose toes are we willing to step on, or what, who are we willing to ignore to make ourselves be seen, and and I'm so, you know, when this whole opioid thing started happening in the U.S., I was so happy that I didn't live there. Because who knows, you know, maybe it's really hard to escape. You know, if you're in that culture and you go to the dentist and he tells you, well, if you have pain, take this. And the first night you have pain and you take it and you think, wow, this is really good. You know? Wow, this is really good. And then you take it some more, you know. I don't know. And for whatever, I don't want to compare cultures and say that this culture is so good and that culture is so bad. I just think that we are fortunately, I feel fortunate to be not as deeply steeped in that culture of greed, anger, and ignorance, or at least in that expression of it, in the same way here. Of course, there's expressions of greed, anger, and ignorance here.
And the drug issue is a big issue.
And the drug issue is a big issue, too. It's different drugs, you know.
We're the biggest consumers of drugs.
Exactly. And the pharmaceutical companies are really powerful here, mm-hmm. incredibly powerful. So I'm not saying that this is all roses mm-hmm. and that's all the pits, but so maybe we could just say, because we see this extreme situation there, and the extreme situation with obesity there, and the extreme situation with guns, and the extreme situation of inequality, how can we then look at our situation and see where that exists here too, and what we can do here, you know? And how, what is that, what are they saying to me? What is all of that saying to me? Not just people, but that, you know, all of that. What is that saying to me? You know, the guy who, the people who commit terrorist acts here, what are they saying? What are they saying? You know, that's an expression of suffering, Matt. That you don't do something like that if you're not suffering. And then when we condemn them and say, oh, they're bad people, or, you know, they're just no good, they, whatever, then what am I, what is that, what am I saying then by that? So,
is that a way of building the scaffolding?
By
taking the pills, or
yeah, absolutely.
Or doing
it's just another scaffolding. Yep, absolutely. Yep, definitely. And even, you know, putting my name on an art gallery is a piece of scaffolding around my identity, you know, that's of course, why not? You know, there's what harm is there in giving a huge donation to the one of the first donations that these guys gave, I think, I'm not sure when it was, but at the Met, there's this Sackler wing, and there's a reconstruction or something from that Egypt donated to some, not really a pyramid, I can't remember what it is, but anyway, something that Egypt donated to the museum, and the Sackler Foundation, the Sackler money, created a space for it and financed all of the organizing of it and installing it there and everything, whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, you can say that that's something positive, you know, that's... Then where does that money come from, you know? And one of the, you know, we have this in Buddhist tradition, there's what they call the Eightfold Path, and one of them is one of the eight things for a whole life is right livelihood, we say. Mm. And so, well, what is right livelihood? Am I doing harm with what I'm doing? Am I doing it from a place of not wanting to do harm? You know? Or trying to not necessarily do good, but by not doing harm, I might be doing something helpful, so maybe something like that. And so we can look at that. You know, well, it's not always easy because sometimes we have to do things. You know, I liked to think that when I was working at a newspaper that I wasn't doing harm. I tried my best to not do harm with what I was putting in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. I can't guarantee that it was always that, but I tried to be sure that it was true, or as true as could be, so that I wasn't spreading false, famous fake news, you know. Tried to make it something that would be meaningful and that would provide information that was meaningful and important, at least according to my standards of what was not doing harm and what was important. I tried to not do harm to my colleagues. I tried to not, if they were doing harm among themselves, not perpetuate it. Whatever. I'm just giving you my example because these questions I asked myself sometimes.
Can I ask a question?
Because
I very much relate to this, and I wonder. So I don't want to do harm. I don't want to pass on pain. I mean, I suffer, but I don't want to put it on other people. Mm. But I think my question is, if I see, I feel that sometimes by not doing it and by not acting out, I feel that still harm is being done to me.
Mm.
And I don't know how to respond. And so far, I decided in a way not to respond. What I'm saying is not to harm others, not to say things maybe out of anger or because I feel hurt. I don't. Okay. But then I'm sitting with pain, in a way, and I don't know what is the right way. As someone who meditates and who thinks, I don't know. I have a lot of. I want to live in a certain way. I want to conduct myself in a certain way. I have these values, and I'm just struggling because I just don't know. I just don't see how what I can do because I see that I'm suffering and I feel. I should respond in some way, but I don't know how.
Hmm.
Is there a way to do?
Yeah, no, okay. I know, and it's
a
good question.
Is there anything that you can? Because I also love this question. What are they saying? What are they saying? I think that's very powerful.
Hmm.
And I guess there's a lot of pain and suffering, but I just don't want to. I don't know. I feel I'm going down. You see, I don't want to exaggerate, but that's in a way sometimes how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not Jesus. I mean, I'm just asking. I don't know what to say. So what is it in my practice maybe that I could do to strengthen whatever needs to be strengthened? Or I don't know.
Mm.
That makes any sense.
No, a very good question.
Tu peux le formuler en français?
Si elle dit si elle ne veut pas perpétuer, elle veut pas faire du mal, elle voit quand ça se produit autour d'elle, elle ne dit rien. Je vais résumer ça. Elle ne dit rien. Mais elle a l'impression qu'en ne disant rien, qu'elle se fait mal. Plutôt que de faire mal aux autres, elle se fait mal à elle. Et que c'est difficile et elle ne sait pas quoi faire. And I think we can all relate to that. whether it's with that emotion or with other emotions, you know, by not acting, not by keeping it in, then we do suffer, you know. So the way that we do harm is when we are coming from a place of an attachment to me. So it's, you know, it's something about me. If we can, you know, I think this, I want that, I don't want that, I do want this, whatever. So if we stay with the emotion, so we experience this emotion, we don't like what they're saying, we don't agree with it, we feel really bad about it, it hurts us to hear it, whatever. If we act from this place of, you're wrong, that's bad what you're saying, How can you do that? If you're coming from that kind of place, well, then you will do harm, probably. I mean, in this, I'm thinking this very simple, but in the sense that it will then just feed it. It's mm-hmm. like throwing oil on it,
yeah. right,
mm-hmm. on the fire. If you come from a place of, that hurts me, I don't function that way. You know, okay, you can function that way, but that it's painful for me to hear that. I'm thinking about the person that you are saying that about, and maybe that person has a difficult situation at this time, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's hard to, these are hypothetical situations,
yeah, yeah.
but I'm mm-hmm. trying to think of my own situations when colleagues would be mean to each other or say bad things about each other. And a lot of the time, it's okay to not say anything. However, it's okay to say things too.
Mm-hmm.
It depends where you're coming from when you say it. That's the key. So that's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It depends where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And that will change immediately what happens. The person might still react in a very aggressive manner, but the way that you experience it will be different. And because you're experiencing it differently, then your reaction will be different,
yeah.
and it won't feed the,
yeah.
the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy, though.
Mm-hmm.
It involves coming back to, okay, you know, that's sometimes why we say take a deep breath, because it involves not reacting just mm-hmm. impulsively, immediately on whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a step back, saying, okay, I see this is what's happening for me. What are they saying to me? Maybe that question is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What are they saying
mm-hmm.
By that? And then when you can see what they're saying, immediately that opens space, because, wow, then you can have compassion for them too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about stupid compassion, like, you know, oh, I feel sorry for you. It's just that you can see that they're coming from a place of hurt, and that's why they're acting that way. Doesn't necessarily it doesn't change that you still hurt, okay, but you can see where that hurt is coming from too, and
mm.
that changes everything. But it's not easy. It's true.
Mm.
Yeah, that question. I'm going to tell that guy when I go back. Excellent question. I haven't written anything yet that I'm supposed to write, but I don't know what to write. Because for me, when I hear a question like that, you know, poetry comes. And I'm not sure that's what they want in this group, but on the other hand, I don't really care what they want, because that's what's coming for me. And that when I hear that question, I have to answer it honestly from my situation. I say poetry, but it can also be kind of, you know, like what I'm telling you now. But it won't be like that, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
If it applies, I'll tell you what I wrote, you know, when I do. And when I, you know, yesterday when I was with the refugees, the same thing, you know, it was just overwhelming. We open up this store to give out clothing, and they're all there, and they're like, madame, 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 madame. And we don't have that, you know, it's pathetic, but you would think that Emmaus would have this huge network of donated clothing, and yet it's just not enough. And we don't have, like, you know, the right sizes. We have, like, lots of huge pants and no shoes and jackets that are too small. Not the right stuff. But anyway, the demand, you know, I want, I want, I want. And just, like, giving, giving, giving was phenomenal. And it really helped me to keep keep in mind, what are they saying? You know, what are they saying to me? And I know what they're saying. They don't have anything, you know. They only have the clothes on there that they're wearing. And you know, some of the people are like, look at their card, and if they already have a coat, you can't give them another coat. Or if they're wearing a coat and they want a coat, you can't give them another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they're like, they show them two T-shirts and they get to choose, right? So you give them a choice, and then so they want to try them both on. And then they end up and they've taken both of the T-shirts. You know, some of the people are like, no, you can't have two T-shirts. I'm kind of like, you know, so what? You know? You know, they say, oh, they're just going to go and sell it in the street. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, okay. You know, so what? They don't have anything. You know, okay, I'm not going to, like, create a black market and give these guys a bunch of clothes they can sell on the street, but so what? You know? It's like I'm listening to them. And, you know, that allows me to just really have a contact with them and talk as much as possible and make jokes and have a relationship with them, even if it's just for 10 minutes, you know? Because I'm not in a space where I'm accusing them of something or assuming something about them or wanting to hang on to what I have, which is not mine anyway, you know? And I don't want to say bad things about my colleagues because they're doing, the fact that they're there is already amazing. You know, these are people who are bénévoles. And they come there, like me, all the time. And so it's already something. I think their experience, I don't know really what their experience is, but they keep coming, so whatever. What are they saying to me? Really good question. So our time is probably up now.
25 past.
Yeah. I've gotten pretty good at this, judging the time.